ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, welcome to PM. I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Tonight, a major development after weeks of searching for missing mother of three, Samantha Murphy. A 22-year-old man has been charged with her murder. Also, South Africa seeks a fresh ruling from the World Court to stop the war in Gaza. This time, its application also applies to Hamas. And new concussion rules to protect grassroots footy players with 3 weeks on the bench.
But I think it's probably a good thing in terms of it will start making people have some conversations about how to protect their head. I think it actually will probably make it easier for players to take it a little bit more seriously.
Thanks for your company. First tonight, Victoria Police have charged a 22-year-old man with the murder of Ballarat woman Samantha Murphy. The mother of three never returned home from a morning run nearly 5 weeks ago. Her mystery disappearance has intrigued the nation and prompted hundreds of volunteers to join the search for her. Samantha Donovan with the latest.
Victoria Police announced this morning that a 22-year-old man had been arrested in the early hours of yesterday morning and was in custody. He's from Scottsburn, about 20 kilometres southeast of Ballarat. A few hours later, the Chief Commissioner, Shane Patton, made this announcement.
The man was interviewed over a number of hours. A number of search warrants have been executed. As a result of those investigations, he has today been charged with the murder of Samantha. We will be alleging that murder occurred at Mount Clear on the day she disappeared. He has not disclosed to police where Samantha's body is.
Now the man has been charged, police can say little about the allegations against him to avoid prejudicing the legal proceedings. But the Chief Commissioner said police aren't looking for an accomplice and he believes the man isn't known to the Murphy family.
We are alleging a deliberate attack which has caused the death of Samantha.
The 22-year-old man appeared in the Ballarat Magistrates Court this afternoon. Shane Patton said he'd been identified through a number of investigative tools.
We've been pinging phones, we've been following up on investigation reports from members of the public, we've done ground searches, we have done door knocks, so it's a whole range of information coming together. I'm not going to identify what has specifically led us to this man, other than to say it has resulted, as came about from painstaking detective work with great assistance from the public.
Earlier today, before the announcement of the murder charge, Ms. Murphy's husband, Mick, told reporters the family was going okay and was pleased the police were making progress. The Chief Commissioner, Shane Patton, confirmed the family was told of the murder charge this afternoon.
Our thoughts and support are with her family. They were under intense scrutiny at the outset, and we, Victoria Police, said everyone should keep an open mind and let us go about our business. They have been cooperative with us, they have provided everything we needed, and they have had no involvement whatsoever in this matter.
Hundreds of volunteers have been searching for Samantha Murphy in the dense bushland on Ballarat's outskirts, and the Chief Commissioner thanked them.
Public and Ballarat surrounding communities, they've been fantastic in the way they've assisted. The volunteers, particularly members of the SES, the CFA, they've helped in the line searches, in continuing searches, but also in the information that has been provided. I know that Samantha's disappearance has had a profound impact on the Ballarat community. Some cases, some disappearances, some murders bring out outpourings of grief, and we've seen that here. So thank you to the community and all those involved, all those who provided assistance in all of those areas.
And he commended his police officers for their huge effort during the investigation so far.
Those who've been involved in the searches from the outset, the responders, those specialist areas, search and rescue, a whole range of other areas, those who've been involved in the painstaking, methodical investigation that's occurred in the bush area, but as well, those detectives from the missing persons unit who've worked very long hours, intensive hours since this occurred. This investigation is far from over, though. Obviously, we're going to be continuing to gather further evidence. We'll be taking further statements, and investigations will continue at a very heavy pace. Importantly, doing everything we can to locate Samantha's body for the family is absolutely vital and something we'll be focusing on.
The 22-year-old man, who can't be named for legal reasons, was remanded in custody and will return to court later in the year.
Samantha Donovan reporting. There's been a fresh attempt by South Africa to force a ceasefire in Gaza through the International Court of Justice. In its application, South Africa warned that Palestinians in Gaza were facing the threat of all-out famine and urged the court to act now. And for the first time, South Africa is also seeking orders that would impact Hamas, not just Israel. Donald Rothwell is a professor of international law at the Australian National University.
South Africa has alleged that as a result of the humanitarian crisis that has been building in Gaza, especially over the last 2 to 3 weeks, and in South Africa's view, Israel's failure to comply with the original set of orders handed down by the court on the 26th of January, there is an urgent need for additional provisional measures to be issued in the situation right now.
This isn't just a request, though, for an order against Israel, is it? It's broader.
Yes, and I think that that's the significant aspect of this additional request, which it needs to be acknowledged is quite an exceptional procedure. But on this occasion, I think South Africa, responding to some of the international criticism that the original request effectively ignored Hamas, the hostages that Hamas has taken, has in fact done two things. One is that it's asked that all of the parties that are engaged in the current hostilities in Gaza cease those hostilities, and that all hostages and detainees are immediately released.
Does it name Hamas directly?
No, it doesn't. And, of course, there's a sensitivity in that regard because Hamas is not a state and the International Court only considers matters concerning states.
Mm. Well, that was going to be my next question. I mean, how beholden are, well, not just Hamas, but Israel too, to any order that is made? Because, yeah, as you say, Hamas is not a state, but, I mean, it's also a proscribed terrorist organisation in many countries, including Australia. And Israel, for example, with the United Nations, has been refusing visas to UN officials and wants the Secretary General to resign.
Well, 2 points here. The first is that it's not unusual that the International Court has from time to time considered the actions of non-state actors, and indeed in most contemporary situations involving armed conflict, there are non-state actors involved. It's just that, of course, the orders of the International Court are only really directed towards states. That doesn't mean to say that the court can't say something about the actions of non-state actors. And of course, the UN Security Council regularly does this. So any observation that the International Court might make about Hamas, we just add to the international pressure and the international commentary in relation to this matter. The second is that Israel is a state. It's a member of the international community. Of course, it's a member of the United Nations. And of course, it appeared before the court when the original set of proceedings were considered in January. And indeed, it needs to be acknowledged that most recently, Australia, New Zealand and Canada, the prime ministers of those three countries on the 15th of February, made it very, very clear that the court's decisions on provisional measures are binding on Israel as a state. And I think increasingly we've seen some very sharpened language around that coming not only from Australia and like-minded countries, but really from all around the world and increasingly perhaps even the United States.
Yeah, so sharp language is obviously one thing, but how likely is it that this challenge could actually force some tangible action on the ground in Gaza?
We're now getting to a pinch point where the language out of Washington, the language from President Biden, the language from US Secretary of State Blinken is really starting to hone in on the humanitarian situation in Gaza. And of course, that's the principal focus of this South African provisional measures request. So if the US position is changing, there's every likelihood now that the Security Council in the United Nations might come up with a really forceful resolution on this issue, which would just combine together with whatever the ICJ has to say to really forcefully put Israel on notice that it really needs to act to deal with the humanitarian situation in Gaza.
How accustomed is the ICJ to dealing quickly with a rapidly evolving situation like this?
Well, it's not unusual that the court is asked to grant provisional measures, and that's becoming an increasingly common request for the court. But it's really absolutely unprecedented that the court is being thrust into the middle of a major global international dispute, but being asked effectively to respond to it every few weeks, which is really what South Africa is requesting. And the previous request that South Africa made dealt with the situation in Rafah, but we've now moved on to the urgent humanitarian situation. So it really places the court in the spotlight of global international affairs and, to a degree, is testing the effectiveness of the court, at least legally, to respond to these issues.
That's Donald Rothwell there, a professor of international law at the Australian National University. After months of escalating attacks on international shipping in the Red Sea, the Houthi rebels have now killed three commercial sailors and injured four others, three of them critically. They're the first fatal strikes by the Iranian-backed group in response to Israel's war on Hamas in the Gaza Strip and follow the first sinking of a cargo ship by the Houthis over the weekend. Rachel Hayter has more.
Smoke pours from bright yellow shipping containers stacked high aboard the MSC Sky 2 in the Gulf of Aden. Indian Navy personnel use hoses to extinguish the fires caused by another Houthi missile.
The Houthis have continued to launch these reckless attacks with no regard for the well-being of innocent civilians.
Matthew Miller is a spokesman for the US State Department. He's talking today about a separate attack on another cargo ship, the MV True Confidence. But this strike was much worse.
Now they have unfortunately and tragically killed innocent civilians.
Three sailors have died and four others have been injured, three of them critically, in the Houthis' first fatal strike on a commercial vessel in one of the world's busiest sea lanes.
It is actually surprising that it's taken this long for there to be loss of life. They've hit over 12 merchant vessels since November.
Jennifer Parker from the Australian National University's National Security College says the Houthis had another first over the weekend with the sinking of the MV Rubimar.
The ship had about 20,000 tonnes of fertiliser and fertiliser-like products on board it. So the Red Sea, which is a pretty delicate ecosystem, and a lot of the coastal countries actually rely on fishing, etc., has now got a significant environmental incident as well to deal with.
In the Yemeni capital Sana'a, which is controlled by the Houthis, thousands have been rallying most Fridays since October 7 in support of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and against Israel and the United States. Today, the US military confirmed it attacked two uncrewed aerial vehicles in a Houthi-controlled area of Yemen. Jennifer Parker argues the US has been relatively discreet in its response to the Houthis to avoid an escalation with Iran. She believes Iran has directly facilitated these latest strikes.
The reports of the anti-ship ballistic missile that hit the MV Confidence overnight, it travelled about 54 nautical miles, so over 110 kilometres. Somebody, something is helping them with targeting it. There are rumours that merchant vessel Bashard, which is a merchant vessel owned by Iran operating in the region, is actually a spy ship that is helping the Houthis target merchant vessels. And to be fair, those reports seem pretty credible.
She says that ship could now be in the sights of the United States.
There is a lot of question about whether there will be a reaction against the MV Bashard, which is probably assisting in targeting these missiles. I think that could be the next step.
But she notes that would be very difficult for the US to do without antagonising Iran. And any US action will be supported in some form by the Australian Defence Force.
Australia announced last year when they declined to send a ship that they would bolster the amount of people in the Combined Maritime Forces. So that increased from about 3 or 5 to roughly 16. The numbers are a little bit hard to follow. In the last 7 days, the Defence Minister actually announced that Australia would send another 6 personnel to Bahrain to work in the headquarters. But unlike supporting the defensive operation, Operation Prosperity Guardian, which is protecting merchant shipping, they would support the US and UK-led attacks. in Yemen, or the response in Yemen.
She says the nature of that Australian support is not clear, but it's most likely keeping watch, communications, and perhaps intelligence.
Rachel Hayter reporting there. You're listening to PM with me, David Lipson. Don't forget, all our programs are available live or later on the ABC Listen app. They may not be playing for big money or fame like their elite counterparts in the AFL, but under new rules being applied to Australian rules football at the community level, players who suffer a concussion will have to remain on the bench for at least 3 weeks. Kids and adults playing the game might also be soon required to wear protective headgear. The new protocols are the latest move by the sport to combat concerns around damage caused to players' brains as a result of repeated head knocks. But players at the elite level will only be benched for 12 days. Nick Grimm explains.
Back, quick, you've got to tag your players.
Training sessions are getting underway around the country for the winter sports season, and junior Aussie rules players are no exception. But this year, the rules they'll follow will be a little different, with those who cop a heavy head knock likely to see themselves on the sidelines for a minimum of 21 days.
But I think it's probably a good thing in terms of it will start making people have some conversations about how to protect their head.
Frankie Freeman is the president of the North Brunswick Football Club in Melbourne, and she acknowledges the new protocols won't be popular with everyone.
Obviously, there's going to be an impact on the volunteer management side of that, and also an impact around how do we manage players' emotions around missing a little bit of extra football. But I think, you know, there are going to be people who are going to want to ignore things like concussions. So having that 21 days there really makes it clear that that's the, you know, the minimum acceptable time before you can come back. I think it actually will probably make it easier for players to take it a little bit more seriously.
Go away. The AFL is introducing the new 21-day rule in states and territories where it has authority over local leagues. And it's working with the game's administrators in Western Australia and South Australia to encourage the same policy there. But under the changes, players at the elite level won't be required to wait as long as their amateur counterparts to return to the game. The AFL argues that's because they're more closely monitored. Danielle Cross is CEO of the South Australian Sports Medicine Association.
Because I think we all know that elite sport and SNFL and AFL have got medical professionals around them regularly. The challenge is in the community and the regions that don't have as much support. They're having very clear guidelines, and the three R's of what we're promoting: you recognise the injury, you remove the person safely, and you refer them to a medical professional.
And players at the community level are being urged not to try to conceal a concussion so they can avoid a three-week layoff.
I would tell those athletes, if you want to reach the elite level, you want to take care of your concussions when you're young. I'm somebody who had to retire from getting too many concussions in a short period of time.
That's Chris Nowinski, a former Harvard University footballer turned professional wrestler until head injury forced his retirement. He's now co-founder and CEO of the Concussion Legacy Foundation.
It makes sense to start promoting these protocols with young people, because what we've seen in the US is that younger people sort of grow up in a game understanding concussions, and they don't have that old school attitude. And it's if you start teaching people to respect their brain young, they'll do it throughout their career.
The AFL will also consider trialling the use of protective headgear for players at the community level. But that's an idea Chris Nowinski does not support.
I don't actually recommend that a contact sport where you're tackling each other involves helmets. I think we've shown at the NFL level in the US that we have the biggest CT problem of all, and we have a massive concussion problem. And anytime you start covering up the scalp, which has pain nerves to tell you don't get hit in the head, you start playing differently and you might get more collisions. And so the helmets were invented to prevent skull fractures, and they don't do such a good job of restricting force to the brain. So I don't encourage players to run out and get helmets. And I think we'll have to monitor that closely, because the more players that are wearing helmets, the more reckless you will see people play, because they aren't getting that feedback of pain when they get hit in the head. And not only that, the feedback yourself, but the feedback when you hit other people with your head.
These protocols are being introduced at the community level here in Australia, but elite players will not be required to follow the same protocols. How appropriate is that in your view?
I think what we have to understand is that the youth game is about developing children, about being healthy and active and learning the benefits of team sports. And so the risk benefit is very different than a professional who is doing this for a living, who might be old enough to understand the risks they're getting exposed to and choosing to go back earlier. And so I think it's okay to have two systems as long as we're dramatically more conservative with younger people who aren't getting paid, who don't understand the risks, who have their entire future ahead of them. And we need to take care of their brains the most.
That's Chris Nowinski, a co-founder and CEO of the Concussion Legacy Foundation. Nick Grimm, our reporter. This week, Queensland became the second state to make coercive control a standalone offence. That's when a person, usually a partner, tries to limit your freedom and independence, for example, not allowing you to go to work, stalking your movements, or changing the passwords on your phone. Now that jail time is on the cards for perpetrators in Queensland, what else can be done to rehabilitate them? Elizabeth Cramsey reports.
With Queensland making the move to criminalise coercive control, perpetrators will now face up to 14 years in prison. It's thanks to families of victims who have advocated tirelessly for the change. Hannah Clark was killed by her estranged husband in 2020, alongside her three children. For her father, Lloyd, years of hard work are finally paying off.
Yeah, very happy that it's been a long 4 years for us. I suppose, some people might say, well, it's only been 4 years, you've done quite well. But I can tell from our end, it has been very long and hard.
He says coercive control is a pattern of controlling behaviour with isolation at its core.
Making her shut her Facebook page down didn't seem like a big thing at the time, but now that when we look back, we think, well, okay, yes, that was the start of the control. He was controlling her to see who she was talking to, and they had to be his friends as well. So certain friends got, barred and weren't, she wasn't communicating with them. So there's that thing of isolating people from them.
New data from the ACT government shows coercive control has been a factor in almost every domestic violence death in the capital across two decades. Annabelle Daniel is the chief executive of Women's Community Shelters. She's not surprised by the report.
There were similar figures that were put forward when New South Wales did its Joint Select Committee investigation into potentially criminalising coercive control a couple of years ago, where the committee looked back at the domestic violence death review results, which showed that in the vast majority of domestic homicides in New South Wales, they had also been preceded by coercive control. And I think what's also really important to note is that coercive control isn't just bad because it leads to domestic homicide. It is bad because living in it is described by victim survivors as a form of intimate terrorism or living in torture. It is very much a form of social entrapment that keeps women tied in abusive relationships.
So now that coercive control is criminalised, does more need to be done to rehabilitate offenders? Sian Ross-Smith is the director of the MATE Bystander Program, educating and empowering people to step in when they see or hear violence and discrimination in their communities.
I was on the board of DV Connect for a number of years, and what I know from our men's line is that often men will phone men's line and say, I actually think I need to seek some help around my use of violence. And then unfortunately, we just didn't have anywhere to refer them. If they did get on a program, there are sometimes up to an 18-month wait list. And by that stage, we know that, they've either lost interest, they've disengaged, they've moved on.
She argues updated programs and resources are needed to make a real difference.
I think we've always had models where we put men in group-based programs, and while that works for some, it doesn't work for all. So I think we need some really effective training for our psychologists and counsellors in Queensland and then Australia-wide around domestic violence, coercive control, so that we can refer men to psychologists and counsellors.
Ms. Ross-Smith says best rates of success are among men who self-refer. That success rate drops off when support is forced on a man by the court. That's why she's calling for more self-guided programs similar to ones offered overseas.
I think if we look at the New Zealand model, they have just rolled out an app developed by Matt and Sarah Brown from She Is Not Your Rehab. And the app is called Inner Boy, and it is a 30-day self-paced, self-help app for men to do the work themselves, on themselves, you know, go back and have a look at some of their trauma, look at some of their use of poor behaviour, and then give them some goal setting.
Sian Ross-Smith ending that report from Elizabeth Cramsey. When the prices of precious metals start soaring, it's usually a sign all is not well with the world economy. So then, should we be concerned that the price of gold has reached an all-time high of $2,160 an ounce? While several battlefronts around the globe did push the price of gold up last year, today its price is actually being driven by what analysts say is good news for borrowers. David Taylor explains.
Professional investor Henry Jennings bought solid gold cufflinks at a charity auction during the pandemic gold boom, and they're now worth a lot more than what he paid for them.
I've rarely worn them, and I've never had them engraved as they're supposed to, and they do weigh a ton.
But rather than buying more physical gold now, he says he prefers to look at buying shares in gold mining companies.
At the end of the day, you get more leverage out of owning gold miners and gold mining shares, whether that's Australian gold stocks or whether it's global gold stocks, but that's where the leverage is. The actual gold moves can be not massive.
The price of gold hit a record high on December 4 last year of $2,135 Australian dollars an ounce. But now even that record's been well and truly smashed, and today it reached $2,160 Australian dollars an ounce. And Henry Jennings says the world's big central banks make up much of the new demand for the precious metal.
39 tonnes of gold in January were added to global gold reserves, and the Chinese and the Turkish central banks have been big buyers of gold. And I guess in this world where we're seeing geopolitical events and problems with fiat money and the ability to just keep printing it, gold, physical gold, has become more attractive, and reserve banks, not only China but India, Kazakhstan, Jordan, the Czech National Bank, even they added 2 tons of gold in January. So there is an awful lot of gold, physical gold, being bought at the moment.
Mark Pavan is a commodities analyst. He says while the threat of war drove demand for gold last year, the expectation interest rates are on their way down is driving demand now.
And what's important about this too is that the gold price is held up strongly through a period of high interest rates, and that's because we've had geopolitical tensions, particularly in the Middle East. So it's sort of a win-win at the moment for gold. It's already been, it's seen the headwinds of high interest rates. Now it's probably going to see a tailwind for lower interest rates going forward, and hence that's why I think there's a real positive sentiment building in gold prices.
So why would investors buy gold on the expectation of falling interest rates? AMP's chief economist Shane Oliver explains.
Obviously, if interest rates are very high, then a lot of people will say, well, I'm worried about things, I want to safe haven, but I could just put my money into a bank account. Providing the bank deposit is guaranteed by the government, I'm perfectly fine, and I'll get my high interest rate from that. But when there's prospect of interest rates falling, it reduces the inclination to put your money in bank deposits or government bonds, and you think, well, okay, I might as well take a punt on gold.
Indeed, Chan Oliver says the price of gold would be even higher if it wasn't for the extraordinary interest in cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin.
Certain people love things like gold, or now Bitcoin, because they feel that it's something that governments can't get their hands on. They can't tax it, they can't take it away, and therefore they feel that they're safe in that investment. And therefore, even though it's questionable as to what Bitcoin will ultimately do, that same group of people who would normally have gone into gold are now thinking, well, yeah, gold's a bit of a hassle, you know, I've got to find somewhere to store the stuff. Whereas Bitcoin's a lot simpler.
And thanks to a US ruling last year, investors can own Bitcoin via what's known as ETFs, or exchange-traded funds, which is essentially investing in Bitcoin via the stock market. As for gold, well, Henry Jennings says, like anything else, it's just a few mouse clicks away for any digital prospectors.
You can go to the website, I guess, of the Perth Mint and buy physical. And there are also dealers around town that will allow you to buy gold. And there's Krugerrands, et cetera, and other countries' gold as well that you can buy.
That's investor Henry Jennings, ending that report by David Taylor. That's the program for today. Thanks for joining us here on PM. I'm David Lipson. The PM team will be back at the same time tomorrow. Until then, good night.
I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. When Donald Trump left the White House in January 2021, it surely wasn't in many people's minds that he could be back. But here we are. Today, the Trump versus Biden rematch for the US presidency that many Americans don't want. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.